this hearing on the Minnesota Senate Tax Committee. Our first item on the agenda is review and adoption of the minutes. If you would review them for the second item in your packet, if there are any corrections, if you would let me know. Any corrections to the minutes? Everybody's name spelled right, et cetera. We don't need a motion. Seeing there are no corrections, the minutes stand approved as presented. The the major topic of today's hearing is to do something that we do in most committees at the beginning of a biennium, and that is find an opportunity to give an overview of the jurisdictions that are assigned to this committee. And usually this would be just a presentation, which will be shortly, of the major tax types and and major, you know, policies that drive Minnesota's tax system. But I thought that might be more interesting to see how that works out in a bill, and in this case, the items that were going to be part of the omnibus conference committee report from last year, that it would be very broad-based and yet could be talked about not in general principles, et cetera, but in the very things, the specific items that members brought to the various two committees and in the Senate, the subcommittee, and in the House, the division on property taxes. So I asked Senate counsel and fiscal analysts to just list the what major topics came up in the that in the end were represented a compromise, or indeed represented the acceptance of a major effort by one body or the other, and that this was, although the spreadsheet, and Senator Nelson, I'm going to count on you, the spreadsheet was signed by the chairs of both committees, the actual conference committee report was not signed, and it was and it was not brought to the floor of either body. Senator Nelson, Senator Weber, and myself were three of the conferees for the Senate. We're going to be taking up Senator Putnam's bill on Social Security starting on Thursday. We'll probably have more than one hearing on it. And we're bringing to the floor today the governor's conformity bill that was also part of last year's effort. And so we're not going to be going through a review of that. We've got the we've got the so those two items and those two articles in the that were part of the discussion in the conference committee last year are not going to come up today. When we have testimony on it, on these items, we're going to ask people to sign up with Mr. Berggren on which article they want to give a minute or two of testimony on. It's a good idea, it was a bad idea, glad you put it in there, needed more work or whatever. And I know that on some, particularly for some more broadly based organizations like the League of Cities, that they may want to make a comment about more than one article. I understand that, but please keep them separate so that we can get through each article as efficiently as possible when it comes to the time to make your comments. I did send a text to the members of the committee, and hopefully for those for whom I did not have a phone number, they got a message from one of their colleagues that I rescinded the no water or I rescinded the other beverages rule for the committee table. It was a silly thing on my part, and I apologize for it. But there is still no consumption among our guests in the audience. You indeed are free to step out and have a cup of coffee or a glass of water or something. We are not, neither is our staff. So the beverage rule will continue as it was in the past. Still no food. Okay, any questions about how we're going to proceed from the members? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say the tax conformity bill is on the floor today or tomorrow?
No, tomorrow.
Tomorrow, okay.
I meant that we were since we're taking it up, we don't have to, we've already passed it out of here, so we don't need to go back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's all. Just the other things. okay, and so Ms. Pollack, I'm counting on you to kind of organize this presentation, if you would. I think if you'd go there would be best, and you all can go there.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one, maybe one just additional comment before we start. All of your comments were spot on regarding the conference committee report, which we're going to kind of review here. The one thing I do want to make sure is clear is it was adopted. Every word of that conference committee report was adopted by the full conference committee. It was just not taken up by the House.
Senator Nelson, I don't remember signing anything.
No, okay, correct.
We didn't sign anything.
Correct.
We were this far away, right?
Correct. All the words were adopted, individual articles, but they were not compiled
and individual
and signed.
That's
Thank
what
you.
I was going to yep. call.
Okay. Senate Counsel, if you would join us up there. And at any point, if in the course of their presentation, you have a question of them, please raise it. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, as Chair Rest mentioned, this we'll be going through a very high overview of some of the provisions that were in the.
Ms. Pollack, you do need to identify yourself for the tape. Sorry.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Nora Pollack, nonpartisan Senate counsel. We'll be going through a very high level overview of some of the provisions in the various articles of the conference committee report from last year that were adopted. I won't go through each provision too much in detail, but of course, if there are questions, we'll be happy to answer them. Starting with Article 2, the income, corporate franchise, and estate tax article. The starting point for Minnesota taxable income is federal adjusted gross income for individual filers and federal taxable income for corporations. So after applying Minnesota-specific additions and subtractions and the various tax rates to various brackets of income to determine Minnesota taxable income, tax credits are applied to then reduce tax liability. So there were several modifications to existing credits and the enactment of a new credit in the 2022 bill. Another provision in this article modified the definition of a qualifying owner and a qualifying entity for purposes of the pass-through entity or PTE tax, which was enacted in 21 to allow pass-through businesses to pay tax on the entity level rather than on the individual owner level. Finally, a modification to the estate tax allows for portability of the deceased spouse's unused estate exclusion amount to be used to reduce the surviving spouse's taxable estate.
So are there any questions about how these provisions were going to work or what was unusual about them in terms of a change? You want to raise anything about that would be helpful to the rest of us?
Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one piece of new news that I was unaware of until yesterday regarding one of these provisions, and that is the new markets tax credit. You might remember we did an immense amount of work on that, and I understand that now other states are looking at that, and they're calling it the Minnesota model. So some of our good work proceeded outside of out of this state on that.
Are you going to reintroduce that?
Yes, I will.
Oh, good. We'll certainly take it up. I have a comment about reducing that first bracket rate. I just read an article, and I think it was in Tax Notes, that even though we might disagree on allowing the highest tax brackets to take advantage of that lower one, but that reducing that first bracket rate that they've done in some other states has had a noticeable, if not significant, impact as a reduction of poverty issue. So I think that makes that particular provision even more interesting to me. Is there anybody on the committee that has a comment to make about these provisions?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Weber, for saving me.
Okay, now we're breaking the equipment. I was just going to ask a question of you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Is it your intent to approve this package once more and we can send it through right away?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, we would be willing to cooperate with you in that venture, Madam Chair.
Maybe. Great question.
Madam Chair, one further comment that could be just important to note on that historic structure rehabilitation mm-hmm. credit. We did repeal the sunset, but there were also two additional provisions that the House accepted from the Senate, which was the transferability and the assignability of those credits, which made them much more valuable. So as we go forward, I think it'd be important not to lose those two additional pieces as well.
What is the justification for repealing the sunset? What was the argument made
well,
there, instead of reviewing it, you know, periodically?
Yes. It currently was on a very short sunset window just because of budget constraints in the previous years. And that was set up before there was the Sunset Review Commission. So the important thing on removing the sunset was that the current law, last year's current law before the almost change, it would have sunset. And it would, and the projects then take a long time to build and the developers to plan. And so it could be, I think, that within that sunset commission, that 10-year revolving piece might be a fine thing to do, but I think the fact that it expired so suddenly was a problem.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Anything else? Then Article 3.
Madam Chair, yes. And just before I move on to Article 3, there was one thing that I wanted to clarify that I'll take responsibility for the Angel Tax Credit, otherwise known as the Small Business Investment Tax Credit. The bullet point indicates that the allocation increase was to $7 million. It was actually an additional $7 million. So the allocation is $5 million for tax year 2022. The provision in the conference committee report was to add another $7 million for a total of $12 million for tax year 2022.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for that correction.
Moving on to Article 3, sales and use taxes. For purpose of these taxes, tangible personal property, which we commonly think of as goods, and specified digital products are taxable unless they are specifically exempted. There are general exemptions, for example, clothing and most food. And then there are exemptions for certain industries or groups, such as agricultural-related exemptions for governments and nonprofit groups, and for certain construction projects. So as you'll see in this article, as you'll see in this list here, there were a various number of exemptions for construction projects, for school districts, and then also for various specific projects in cities and at the airport. There were some changes made to the exemptions for food licenses in suites and for the amenities that are included with admission to suites and box seats in stadiums. And finally, Madam Chair, there was a kind of unique exemption for natural gas charges that were incurred in the extreme weather of, I believe, February of 2020. The issue there is that we do have an exemption for sales tax that are applied to purchases of natural gas for residential customers in the cold weather months in Minnesota. The way that that played out was that because of the steep increase in the prices for residential natural gas that year, those costs were spread out across the year. And so that had the effect of not the exemption not applying in the warmer months when the exemption doesn't apply. So this was a kind of unique situation that was adopted in the conference committee report for this issue. Madam Chair, I don't have any more comments unless there are other questions.
Ms. Pollack, is there any indication that the extreme weather events we've had so far this year in Minnesota is going to occasion looking at that at that type of issue again with regard to gas charges?
Madam Chair, I don't know. To my knowledge, the issue from 2020 arose quite a few months later when there was when it became known that these price increases occurred, you know, after the fact. So I think it's a little too early to tell now whether that could occur again.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sylvia, or anybody have a question or a comment? Oh, Senator Klein.
Madam Chair, Ms. Pollack, with regards to the construction materials specifically for public safety facilities, et cetera, I believe we discussed at some point last session making that, instead of doing that on a case-by-case basis, making that a statewide policy, which seemed prudent to me. Is that your recollection as well? And can you describe why that did not become policy in the final omnibus?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Klein, and members, the exemption for construction materials is a kind of unique situation. We do have an exemption for a sales tax exemption for purchases by governments, local governments, and other similar entities. The issue with construction projects is that the sales tax exemption only applies to construction materials that are purchased as part of non-lump sum contracts. So this means the materials and the labor are all bid as one package. It's very rare that a construction contract would be entered into with a separate bid for materials and a separate bid for labor. So the effect of that is that the local governments can rarely take advantage of that exemption just because of the way that construction contracts generally work. And that's the reason for this kind of piecemeal approach that we've taken so far to approve on a project-by-project basis. Senator Klein's question about doing this on a full-scale basis has come up over the last several years. I think, it as often happens when we're putting together a conference committee report, it comes down to, the revenue effect of enacting this type of more full-scale exemption.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Sylvia.
Madam Chair and members, Eric Sylvia from Nonpartisan Senate Council. I'll be going through the property tax article. The first bullet point in the list contains three education provisions. On occasion, the tax bill, specifically a property tax article, would include education proposals, but not always. Mr. Arneson's prepared to speak to those if there are any specific questions. Otherwise, the property tax article itself included several changes to property tax exemptions, property classifications, classification rates, as well as providing for new property tax programs. The second point includes reference to property tax exemptions. There were four property tax exemptions included in last year's article. Two were site-specific, so they apply to only one particular parcel, and two were general in nature, so that any particular property that would meet the qualifications would have applied and could then be exempt. In addition, I'll just note the difference between, in perpetuity versus time-limited exemptions. Both the tribal-owned exemption and the elderly living facility exemption was time-limited, so only applied for a number of years. Rather, the exemption for the airport property and energy storage systems were in perpetuity. The article also contained a new affordable housing market value exclusion program, not a tax credit, but an exclusion program geared specific to new class 4A apartments that would reduce the taxable market value of those properties. The article contained three changes specifically for agricultural properties, the first being increasing the first tier valuation limit for ag properties. Ag properties, like other classifications, are subject to two different classification rates, and this particular proposal increased the first rate. The second change to ag properties were to modify the list of qualifying relative. So those relatives that could farm or actively farm on behalf of an owner and still claim ag homestead, this proposal modified that definition to include additional relatives. And lastly, the definition of agricultural product was also modified to include industrial hemp. In order to be classified as Class 2A ag, the farm must be actively producing an agricultural product, and this was a definitional change to bring in some additional properties. The article also created a new class rate and lowered the class rate for existing community land trust properties. The article made changes.
Excuse me, Mr. Sylvia. Could you expand a little bit on what community land trust property is? I don't remember any details.
Sure, Madam Chair and members. Community land trusts are typically an entity that would purchase property and then either sell or rent to lower income people. The difference between community land trust property and other types of property is that the community land trust typically retains ownership of the land itself, and then the individual occupant would sort of create a land rental payment. The way the classification works right now is if the property is occupied and used as a homestead, it would qualify for homestead treatment as Class 1A and be subject to either a 1% class rate or 1.25% class rate, depending on the value of the property. What this specifically did in this proposal was to create a new, what we called Class 4D2 property, but lower the class rate for all property to 0.75. So under this proposal, community land trust property would receive a 0.75 class rate rather than the current law, 1 or 1.25% class rate.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair and members, this article also included a change to the homestead market value exclusion by increasing the value threshold and maximum exclusion and maximum point where the exclusion itself would phase out. Three changes were made to the Class 4D low-income rental housing program. Those changes were to require a property owner receive approval before applying for Class 4D designation for new properties, eliminate the current two-tier class rate, and lower that class rate for all Class 4D properties to 0.25%, and lastly, to require a property tax savings reduction study and report for communities to indicate the properties with the most 4D and how the property owner used the property tax savings resulting from the class rate change. This article also included another class rate change to Class 1C homestead resorts. These are resorts, commercial property that abut public water or trail. Again, this property is also subject to a tiered classification system, and for purposes of this proposal, the tier breaks were changed. Two changes were made to the disabled veterans homestead market value exclusion, one by extending the application window for widows of veterans who died during active service, and lastly, to allow qualified spouses who at one point received the exclusion but was no longer eligible because the time period had expired before the law change to a potential lifetime benefit. So in both cases, the application window was extended. A definitional change was made to a cooperative association-specific proposal. Just a bit of a background. Under general law, cooperative utilities distribution lines, including attachment and appurtenances, are exempt from personal property taxes. There was an issue with what exactly is an attachment and appurtenance. Does that include metering and street lighting? And this was a definitional change to specify that for purposes of this definition, metering, street lighting was attached. A change was made to the state general levy by reducing the levy amounts for both commercial, industrial, and seasonal recreational properties. A change was made to the senior citizen property tax deferral program by...
Excuse me, Mr. Sylvia, Senator Glover.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Into the state general levy, didn't we also approve or have included the elimination of that over a 10-year program?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Sylvia.
And Senator Weber, what was ultimately included in the conference committee report was just a reduction for the state general levy for both seasonal rec and commercial industrial properties.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair and members, a change was made to the senior citizen property tax deferral program. Two changes. First, it was increasing the maximum household income eligible for the program, and lastly, lowered the residency and occupancy requirement. A change was made to interest rates for purposes of confessions of judgment and delinquent property taxes by eliminating a minimum interest rate charged so that counties could essentially decide on a lower interest rate and would not be subject to that minimum. And lastly, Madam Chair, members, under current law, manufactured home parks have three separate property tax classifications. The conference committee report consolidated all three of those into one property classification and set one class rate.
Okay, any questions or comments about Article 4? Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, Bjorn Arneson, nonpartisan Senate analyst. Article 5 is the property tax aids and credits article. And you know, typically this article would be the vehicle for modifications in especially Chapter 477A, LGA, and CPA, and other aid programs. Policy changes in 477B and C for the police and fire aids, and other other aid programs, permanent or one-time aid programs to local governments. The six bullets here represent the most significant proposals in this article, you know, by dollar amount, by annual dollar amount. The first bullet is an LGA appropriation increase. Members may remember that coming into conference, there were a few LGA proposals that modified the distribution formula and increased the appropriation. In addition, there were a handful of provisions that forgave aid penalties for a few small cities that had not timely filed their required financial reports, and as a consequence, had their had at least one of their biannual aid payments withheld. The adoption, the conference committee adopted an LGA proposal that didn't modify the formula but increased the appropriation amount by about $30 million a year, beginning in aids payable in 2023. Similarly, the county program aid, or CPA program, was proposed to increase its appropriation by also $30 million a year, beginning in the same pay 2023 year. This article also proposed a modification of the PILT program, or Payment in Lieu of Taxes program, and would have increased the PILT program for just general PILT acres, and then also in jurisdictions with a high proportion of PILT acres. And if members have questions on that particular provision, Mr. Silvio would be the greater expert on the program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I do have just one quick question on that provision. Inflation indexed payment amounts. Is this, I don't remember the inflation indexed piece, and if that is new, or if it was just the increase, or if it was the increase equaled the inflation adjustment, or is that ongoing, the inflation adjustment? Can you explain that?
Sure. Madam Chair, Mr. Senator Nelson and members, the inflation piece itself is new. So under current law, there's a set payment per acre. This proposal, as Mr. Arneson indicated, increased the payment per acre amount for some properties, but also added this additional piece so that those payment per acre amounts would then be indexed for inflation ongoing.
Thank you. That was my question.
Madam Chair, members, the fourth bullet under this article is titled Electric Generation Transition Account. Members may remember that coming into conference, the Senate had proposed a program that that would have provided some transition aid for taxing jurisdictions in which electric generating units were retired. Those units tend to be tax, you know, property tax paying units that pay sometimes a fairly significant portion of the property, total property tax for a jurisdiction. And when those units are retired, that can sometimes have a challenging budgeting and tax rate effect for those jurisdictions. In the end, the conference committee did not adopt the Senate proposal, but did set aside in an account for later legislative action just over $5 million for a future legislature to allocate to a program like this. This article also proposed changes to the creation of a soil and water conservation district aid. Those districts right now are funded, though they're funded on a biennial basis from the Clean Water Fund, and those decisions are made, you know, by the folks writing that bill on a biennial basis. This program would have been a permanent aid coded in Chapter 477A, amounting to about $6 million a year in new funding over and above what is currently available out of the Clean Water Fund. And lastly, the last significant program in terms of dollar amount in this article was a community career workforce grant program brought into conference by the House. And just in general, this would have been a grant program where community career workforce academies could apply for grants through their local workforce development board. The grant program would have been funded out of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and the appropriation would have been made to that commissioner. Madam Chair and members, that concludes the most significant items in the property tax aids and credits article.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson. Any questions or comments?
Madam Chair, just...
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one comment on the last bullet point, the community career workforce grants. That did come over from the House. But what I do think it's somewhat important to know that it's actually modeled after PTEC, Pathways in Technology, Early College High, which was a Senate provision several years ago. We have one PTEC school in Minnesota at this point, highly successful. And so it was kind of modeled after something that the Senate had done earlier as far as PTEC.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sylvia.
Madam Chair and members, I will briefly go through what was Article 6, the tax increment financing article. As members are aware, most tax increment financing districts are created by authorities without ever coming to the legislature. The only time that the legislature and specifically the tax committee will see TIF proposals is if there is either a change to general law or specific cities are asking for special laws. And the tax increment financing article include examples of both. The first half of that article included changes that were recommended by the Office of the State Auditor, their TIF division, after having a months-long working group to address ambiguities, to improve oversight, and the ability of TIF authorities to comply with TIF law. And there were a number of technical and policy changes made that is included in this TIF article to address administrative expenses, pooling, and violations. And the second half of the TIF article were those city-specific special law requests. And the cities of Fridley, Plymouth, Savage, Shakopee, and Woodbury all received special law changes to allow their projects to move forward that would not have otherwise worked under the current law TIF restrictions.
So, Mr. Sylvia, with regard to the individual cities' special legislation, can you just refresh us on what were the provisions that are most generally or frequently, not generally, frequently asked as to be set aside or modified in the special law requests? And do you recall the rationale that cities gave for those changes? You would refresh us on that.
Sure, Madam Chair and members, I would say that there are probably three very common special law requests that the tax committee will see. And the first one would be an exemption from what's called the blight test. Redevelopment tax increment financing districts are 25-year districts, and the purpose is to develop blighted properties, properties that would not have been developed otherwise. But in order for a redevelopment district to be created, you have to meet the blight test. There's a definition statute, substandard buildings, things of that nature. In many cases, there will be parcels of land that simply will not meet that statutory test for the blight test. And without that, a redevelopment district could not be created. So it's not uncommon for authorities to come before the legislature and ask that a particular parcel of property be deemed to meet the blight test so that that parcel could either be included, or in some cases that parcel is the only parcel for purposes of a redevelopment TIF district. I think the second probably most common exemption request would be an exemption from the five-year rule or maybe an extension of the five-year rule. In this case, is most of the development activity must occur within the first 5 years of certification of the TIF district. There are times when authorities come forward and because of development delays or other occurrences, development was slow to start and that five-year window is approaching, or five-year expiration window is approaching, and cities ask for one additional or two additional years so that they would meet the five-year rule, because beginning in the sixth year is when the increment that is collected must be used to essentially pay expenses that were incurred during those first 5 years. And lastly, I would say maybe pooling exemption or duration extensions are both common. I indicated that redevelopment districts are the 25-year districts. All TIF districts have a duration limit, and sometimes authorities will come forward to the legislature and ask for an additional year or two so that the TIF district itself can continue. Otherwise, once there's enough increment set aside to pay off expenses, or once the district has met that duration limit, then the district itself must be decertified.
Okay. We will be seeing, I'm sure, additional or maybe the same tax increment financing special laws, and definitely the state auditor's policy and technical changes that her staff, along with a working group of interested parties mostly from the cities, have been working again over the interim, and we'll be seeing that bill as well. And there seems to be unanimity among the participants in adopting those changes going forward. So that is the general policy changes will definitely be having a hearing on. And then everybody's favorite, local sales taxes. January 31st. All you lobbyists out there, just remember, cities have to get their information in by the 31st. The bills can come later, but the information has to be by January 31st. That's a rule that exists both in the House and the Senate. It's in statute. I believe it's going to be strictly enforced. And anybody that had one of these last year doesn't hold over. And most of the cities who did have them, as I understand it and being told, since inflationary costs have had an impact on the cost of the projects that they want to fund through their sales tax, they are having to reconsider the amounts. And you can't just do that automatically. You have to submit a new bill. But if Ms. Pollack, if this is your section, right? Yes. If you would talk a little bit about what kinds of projects those cities came up with, and what they were attempting to use the local sales tax to fund.
Madam Chair and members, yes, just to take a step back before I describe the types of projects, as Chair Rest mentioned, a few things must happen before a local jurisdiction comes before the tax committee to seek authorization for their local sales tax. First, they must pass a resolution indicating support of a project or projects. The resolution must describe things like the proposed tax rate, a description of the projects that would be funded with the revenues from the tax, the amount of revenue that would be needed to be collected for each project, and the estimated time that the tax would be in effect to raise that amount. The resolution must also state the total amount of revenue that would be needed to be raised for all projects if there were more than one. And then, of course, as Chair Rest mentioned, the local jurisdiction must submit the resolution and documentation that supports the regional significance of each project to the chair and ranking member of the tax committees in both bodies by January 31st of the year that they are seeking the authorization of the tax. Madam Chair, the types of projects that were authorized in the bill last year included athletic facilities and community and civic centers, public safety facilities and correctional facilities, public works and maintenance facilities, libraries, and parks and trails improvements. There were also some changes to the general law that applies to the authorization of an enactment of local sales taxes. Many of those things were clarifying, for example, clarifying that the requirements that I just outlined apply to modifying local sales tax, such as increasing the duration of it, adding another project, and not just to a new sales tax. There were some other changes made that the local jurisdiction would need to supply additional documentation about the nexus between the use of the project and how non-residents for that local jurisdiction are related. Madam Chair, as you also referenced, there were we heard last year a number of local jurisdictions come before the committee who had been authorized in the 2021 omnibus tax bill, who had realized increased costs for the projects that were authorized in 2021. In some cases, it was less than $1 million. In some cases, it was much, much more. And so there was a special provision included that allowed cities to seek voter approval for up to $3 million additional dollars for their projects that had been approved in 2021. They would have had to submit an updated resolution and so forth, indicating the need for this increased amount. But that was a kind of unique situation. And so I would assume that this year, being that we'll be seeing new proposals, we might see more of those modifications to projects that were approved in 2021.
Thank you. I think the individual cities that are making these proposals, I think, indicate to me that we have a failure in our property tax system, which is generally, I think, thought of as being responsible for providing infrastructure improvements of one sort or another, including things like the daycare center, which I find to be the most interesting and innovative project for any number of reasons. And I'm trying to see, I don't remember which city it was.
Madam Chair, that was Warren that was authorized in 2021, and they were one of the cities that had a relatively small increase request, and they would have been covered by that $3 million allowance.
And I think their original request was something like $1 million, they thought, and for how many years?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure of that, but I can check right now.
And I'm trying to, sorry, I don't know the geography. Whose district or where is this?
I believe that's Senator Johnson, Madam Chair.
Senator Mark Johnson's? Okay. So that must mean northwest Minnesota. And, all of these things are being proposed, and it just strikes me as the inadequacies of the property tax providing the revenues for these infrastructure projects, and instead spreading that cost outside of the city, and we get the justification that folks outside of the city limits are ones that benefit from the services or project, and so it's legitimate, it's a legitimate policy perspective that that they use the sales tax mechanism to pay for it.
Madam Chair?
I just wonder, one second, I just wonder long time ago, having a statewide policy regarding local sales tax projects, this is like 20-some years ago, was part of the omnibus tax bill, and Governor Perpich vetoed the bill, and one of the major reasons was he did not think that that should be an option granted in a general policy way to each and every citizen city, but we see it coming back over and over again for individual city. Senator Weber.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think the other thing we have to recognize in that whole discussion is that the same reason that LGA exists, for example, is that communities across the state have a wide variation of availability of taxable property and property values. Mm-hmm. And yet many of their needs remain the same as a high property value community. And so maybe on a reduced basis, but still needs nevertheless. And over the years, we have managed probably to find different solutions to the same issue, whether it's providing daycare. We have a greater tendency to have in-home daycares in rural Minnesota mm-hmm. than probably mm-hmm. exists in the metro area. And yet what happens is the state, with the rulemaking that exists, make it increasingly difficult for many of those operators to continue, and thereby we create an inequity even in terms of our communities and our citizens to provide services that are needed. You know, and I think that the challenge, and I probably never agreed with Governor Perpich a great deal, but I tend to agree with him on that particular issue. I think that we are always going to see a great difference between communities, and to just offer some of these changes carte blanche sometimes provides a windfall for some communities while trying to meet basic needs of another. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that state policy should do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Sir Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a great discussion on the local option sales taxes. And I would just emphasize the word local, adding on to what's already been said. Each community is so incredibly
Everybody
different.
Everybody gets a half a cent somewhere along yeah, the counties do it. Right?
Yes, exactly. And the one point I would mention, too, in addition to Senator Weber's comments, some cities, we have a few regional centers in our state, which have a very different issue, and that is having tens of thousands of people come in every day who, and the cities need to be able to accommodate that, but that doesn't necessarily equate to property taxes. One of the things that I've noticed in the last few years is that regional centers particularly need the local option sales tax to be able to provide the services for all those who come. But it's also important, I think, to share some of those local option sales taxes with those surrounding communities in the metropolitan statistical area, for example, as a way to serve both.
That was, I think, one of the original motivations for fiscal disparities, which in the metropolitan area seems to have gone wild at some points. It's okay if I call on Senator Putnam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up on Senator Nelson's point.
Sure.
With a particularly stark illustration of this concern, both in terms of the challenges placed on regional centers and the specific needs that they have. So the city of Way Park, over 80% of the crime that happens in Way Park is from people who don't live in Way Park. So we have a very particular need for public safety investment in that area that is very local, but also a function of everyone who lives around us. So we need extra help to help with the fact that we are a regional center with a regional concern, because we're serving a larger area than our property tax base will allow us to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would also go back a number of years. I remember it was about 9, 10 o'clock one evening. Senator Gazelka, who was the GOP lead on the tax committee at that point, called me and asked me to come to a meeting in yours and Senator Scoy's office at that point, as we were discussing the Lewis and Clark Regional Water Pipeline that was we were trying to get funding for to come into Southwest Minnesota.
Yes, indeed.
And at that time, Senator Scoy was trying to work out a local option sales tax for the communities in my district in order to fund that rather than use bonding money or cash. Or I think we had a couple of different bonding options over the years to get that project completed. But even that, at times, Madam Chair, depending on the size of the project, it was not an option, just because in rural areas, our sales are still limited many times because of the size of our communities. And even with one of my communities, I mean, the largest community in my district is a population of approximately 13,000-14,000 people, and there's just only so much you can generate with a local option sales tax, even in that scenario. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it certainly is not the cure-all for everything, but at times it can indeed help.
Senator Weber, how many the cities in your district, and this is for the rest of you as well, got their urban-rural classification turned upside down with the latest reports from the Census Bureau? Are you aware? I mean, I think it used to be 2,500, and now they're making it, or 5,000, now they're making it 2,500. Which way did that flip? It's just in the news.
Well,
it's going to make a difference in terms of those aid that comes into the state and to a number of local communities, how they are classified. And I think now I'm recalling it, that used to be if you were going to be classified as a city, it had to be 5,000, and now it's 2,500, which I don't know all the implications of the difference, but there certainly are going to be some, and some communities, I think it was Lonsdale, that consider themselves fairly rural, and all of a sudden they're now an urban center, and it is really surprising the dickens out of them.
Well, Madam Chair, I would say that with the number being at 5,000, I would have only had one city in my entire district that would have qualified as being a city for those kind of purposes. Everyone else, my hometown of Laverne is 4,950 some people. I mean, we all fall under that $5,000 limit. That manifests itself in the Transportation Committee often as to who gets, local street aid and this type of thing. So I think, you know, if that was to go down to 2,500, it would have an impact in a district such as mine.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, did you have a further comment?
Oh, yeah, just briefly, Senator Weber really hit much on it, which is the transportation dollars really often determined by the population of individual cities or towns. But the one thing I just wanted to add, in addition to all the good discussion, is that is the beauty of the local option sales tax. It's locally determined, but the one thing we did not say, which I think is so important, is the locals determine, they vote on it in a referendum. So it's not the state doing this to the locals. We're allowing the local entities to go to its voters with a referendum, and the voters have the final say for those local issues.
I would point out, however, with regard to trying to export or import, whatever the correct word would be there, of who pays for it, there are no car dealerships in the city of Minneapolis anymore. They're all outside, because who wants to pay that additional half cent or whatever in sales tax on huge ticket items when you can go 5 miles and all of a sudden you get a 0.5% discount?
True.
You know? So cities have to be careful when they're when they are considering passing resolution and coming here for approval. Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, you know, as we do these taxes, and Senator Nelson talks about Rochester, which is close to both of us, closer to her than me. But the fact that 50% of the revenue is derived from the surrounding small communities, and they don't get a vote. They don't get to vote on this. They don't get to vote on taxation that they're obviously paying. So I struggle with that notion. But I would hope that if we do these types of approvals, especially for those regional centers, and I agree with Senator Nelson, that we consider those small communities and figure out how to bring some of that money back to them if indeed it is passed on them as we go forward. I'm wondering, I remember discussions in the other body about LOST and the creep, if you will, in terms of what these projects, the types of projects that have been approved. I'm wondering, does staff know, what do we have in law right now really telling us what local communities can use this for? Because we've heard daycare, and I remember hearing across the street all kinds of things. The creativity, it just flows when people can look at exacting money that belongs to other people and using it for their purpose. So I'm curious what we have in law right now.
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair, Senator Drazkowski, yes, in 2021, there was the legislature enacted a specified list of the types of projects that can be funded with local sales taxes. So what is the definition of a capital project? It is a single structure, a single building or structure, included any associated infrastructure needed to safely access or use that building or structure, improvements within a single park or named recreation area, or a contiguous trail. You're right. Since this has been enacted, we've seen requests for projects that are outside of that definition, and that's generally a conversation with the committee as to whether to not withstand that requirement. I should also mention before this definition was enacted in 2021, there were any number of types of projects that were that local sales tax revenues were dedicated to. So, for example, street and water projects, those would not fall within the definition as it is in law now.
I also, to your point, Senator Drazkowski, kind of these inner relationships between a city that imposes the tax and the people who live outside of it who are actually paying it. And as I recall, I don't know how long ago it was, but we had a proposal that, and one of the cities was Baxter. And the proposal that ended up coming to us is that it would be imposed by one city, but then because so many residents from the nearby communities were actually paying into it. The actual proposal then said that a portion of those revenues were going to go back to those that surrounding community. Is it a city that starts with a G up there? Baxter and
Garrison.
And Garrison.
Garrison, Grigola.
And Garrison, and they had a kind of a shared agreement there, imposed in one city because that's where the commercial stuff was, but being paid for by the people that lived around because one of the two cities was so small that then they had a kind of a mutual aid agreement that, that it could be shared. I thought that was interesting but unique rather than the city of Rochester and its surrounding things.
Well, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we did that in with the city of Rochester back in 2016 or something like that. Chair Davids called it affectionately the Good Neighbor Program.
Oh, okay. Mutual aid, good neighbor.
The Greg Davids Good Neighbor,
yeah.
Good Neighbor
of course
Program.
He would.
And of course, he branded it properly.
Yeah.
And so it did that. It considered those small cities within a prescribed radius of the regional center that had economic development authorities in them were given a prescribed amount, mm-hmm. a one-time lump sum that was supposed to be used for economic development activities sure. In their area.
Madam Chair.
Senator Putnam, did you have a further comment?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so in response to, or to follow up actually on Senator Drazkowski's point, which I think is a valid one, there is a distinction, I think, policy-wise, between the principles of local option sales tax and the elasticity of their implementation. Those aren't the same question.
Mm-hmm.
And so for my example, and this is probably oversimple, I think of someone driving in from Avon, going to Waite Park. They go and they spend money. They go to Applebee's. They go to McDonald's, whatever, apparently. They spend money in Waite Park. They drove on streets to get there that they didn't pay for because they're not part of that tax base. So they are, in order to be charged the tax, they have to be taking advantage of the tax at the same time because they had to come to the town in order to spend the money for it to go where it needs to go. And those roads in the places in my community are not going to survive if we don't have help because of the excessive use that's happening because of the great deal of use that's happening from surrounding communities. So that's just a simple example from my example. And the local option sales tax that's for Waite Park that's in this bill is for exactly that. It's for roads that increase commerce. And it's commerce coming from people who live all around the area. So in that case, although they didn't get to vote on it, they are contributing to it. And I think that's an important distinction.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Putnam. Senator Nelson?
Oh, yes. A great discussion, Madam Chair, on local option sales taxes. Just to kind of tie all those together, Senator Drazkowski's right. The previous Rochester local option sales tax had kind of an arbitrarily defined circle that would share in some of those profits. The Rochester local option sales tax bill that this committee and the conference committee agreed upon last year was a bit of an improvement on that in that it took that already defined geographic, federally defined Rochester metropolitan statistical area
mm-hmm.
as far as that is the area that would share in those economic development funds. So everyone is a part, and it was already, I guess, already determined, you know, what that economic development area is through the RMSA or whatever Waite Park MSA, Metropolitan Statistical Area. So it was kind of a refinement on that good neighbor policy, which was to use an already defined economic development region.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the discussion. I am sure we're going to get a number of requests, even if it's different cities than the ones that are here, and I do hope it is a topic of conversation as well, not only here in the legislature, but with the League of Cities and the small cities organizations as well welcome their suggestions for dealing with some of these challenges that we find in local sales taxes. Ms. Pollack, if you want to continue, I think maybe we have finished with Article 7.
Madam Chair, members, I will discuss briefly Article 8, the renter's property tax credit. And members, this article converted the renter's current property tax credit into a refundable income tax credit. The amount of the credit is essentially calculated the same way, except under current law, the property tax refund takes into consideration other types of non-taxable income, whereas under this proposal, the income tax credit would equal adjusted gross income minus exemptions allowed for dependents, taxpayers who are 65 years or older, and taxpayers who have a disability. Another significant change as a result of this move is that under current law, a renter would apply for the credit and receive the refund either in September or October, but moving it on to the income tax credit, then that renter would receive the refund, you know, at the same time as, you know, any other refunds for which the applicant would receive otherwise. But essentially, you know, the sort of meat of the proposal is the same. It's just moving it from property tax credit, separate M1 PR document, onto the income tax form.
Any comment on that? We are going to see similar proposal has already been introduced. In years past, because applying for the renter's credit or property tax refund for homeowners, the actual check that comes, as you just mentioned, is in the next fiscal year, and but you apply for it generally earlier, and so there was the argument that there was a disconnect between applying for the renter's credit, which is supposedly helping pay your taxes, because housing, every person in a housing unit pays a property tax of one sort or another, however it's imposed. And so it was just too far apart. But then recently, a comment was made to me that if the renter's credit reduces your income taxes, or is and it's refundable, so can go beyond what you even owe if you owe anything, and it's paid or applied for and received in the current year, that then when you get to September, people are going to say, where's my check? Because they wanted to use it for school clothing or this or that and the other thing, and now we have a disconnect of a different kind. And we'll be looking at that proposal, but I think that's a valid discussion. One reason why it's even possible, because even though it's been promoted in the past, it is because, of course, the one-time surplus money, because this is shifting into another fiscal year, and it's a one-time cost reduced over a couple of years because of the way those credits work. So it's not just one time and done. It'll, as I understand it, there's some residual effects in the revenue estimate beyond that. But it's kind of like, you know, where you stand depends on where you're sitting on that kind of benefit of a property tax reduction accompanying the income tax forms or waiting. And in my book, the time value of money overcomes that kind of disconnect, and the quicker you can get tax relief to a taxpayer, the better it always is. But we'll see where that discussion leads us this year. Who has the public finance article?
Madam Chair, members,
the public. And Mr. Sylvia, would you explain how we get this public finance article, where it comes from, Sometimes it's a lot of provision, sometimes they're minor, but who gives us ideas for the public finance article?
Madam Chair, members, the public finance article typically contains provisions that are brought forward by the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance after sort of a similar working group with their members to get together to discuss changes that are necessary, again, clear up ambiguities or make, you know, complying with current law, you know, easier. In the past, the public finance articles contain provisions that are deemed non-controversial. If any member, you know, in both body indicated some disagreement with a proposal that was put forward, it's been, you know, customary practice that that provision would be immediately amended out of the proposal, worked on, and if, you know, it's deemed satisfactory, included again, or, you know, and if an agreement is not reached, then that proposal would just simply not be included in this article. There have been times where the public finance article has included other provisions not brought forward by that group, you know, local debt financing provision, things of that nature, but that itself is not included. What is included in Article 9 public finance article is that proposal from the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance, and it simply makes the same change in multiple sections, and that is to extend the duration limit from 10 to 20 years for, you know, certificates of indebtedness and capital notes issued by cities, towns, school districts. Having said that, the law also requires that the bonds comply with sort of the useful life of the equipment itself. So although we're in this proposal extending the duration limit from 10 to 20 years, if the useful life of whatever particular equipment is purchased is less than that, then that, you know, duration limit of the useful life of the equipment would apply. I know during the committee, I believe one city indicated, you know, a fire truck, and if the useful life is less than 20, whatever that useful life is would apply, even though we're extending the duration limit.
Okay, any questions on the public finance bill? I would, in terms of the renter's tax credit, going back to that, you know, the one proposal, I'm not sure if it's in your bill, Senator Klein, is, you know, it's a relationship of the taxes you pay or assume that you pay relative to your income. And one of the features of some renter's credit proposals have been to redefine what income means, whether it is household income as we now have it, or whether we use AGI in that instance, and it does have a different impact, as I understand it. Last year, this was not a Senate provision, it was a House provision, but we will be discussing it this year as well. Okay. Who's doing Article 10?
Madam Chair, members, I'll lead us through Article 10. Many of these miscellaneous provisions, or some on this page, would be more the expertise of other staff here, and if there are detailed questions, I can refer them to other staff, but I'll walk the committee through it. Article 10 is a miscellaneous article, and as members probably expect, you know, it contains a combination of provisions that don't neatly belong to other articles. The first bullet here indicates some proposed modifications to the Tax Expenditure Review Commission provisions. In general, you know, the proposal that the conference committee adopted would have had the effect of, rather than requiring a purpose statement in the bill text itself, the proposal would have required the chairs of the House and Senate Taxes Committees to submit a purpose statement to the Tax Expenditure Review Commission, or TERC, after the proposal was enacted.
And I will say that the TERC did meet during the interim for its first 6 month period, and then the House was the chair, and then the Senate will be the chair, as I understand it, at least for the next 2 years. But they did submit their report by December 15th, and we will ask at some point near future to ask the LBO to present the findings or the recommendations or provisions of that report. We'll get a report here in the Senate Tax Committee.
Madam Chair and members, the second bullet item there is a proposal that resulted from an issue arising in the published forms for filers. In some cases, the ambiguity on the form led filers to underpay their tax liability. And it's my understanding that the agency, as a way to resolve this, collaborated with the legislature to strike the $50 payment requirement that existed in current law for entering into a tax payment agreement with DOR. This would apply to any filer entering into a tax payment agreement, not just limited to those impacted by the form issue. And then secondly, to modify the time period in which the collection could be undertaken for certain underpayments of individual taxes. The third bullet relates to retirement plan distributions. Under current law, periodic and non-periodic payments or distributions from deferred comp plans, individual retirement plans, and commercial annuities are subject to Minnesota tax withholding unless the recipient opts out. Under current law, the withholding amount may be determined by some calculation using tax tables, which can be quite difficult for both the recipient and the payer of the amount. And this proposal would have provided that the withholding rate is a flat 6.25% unless the recipient determines some other amount. So it provides some kind of certainty about how much would be withheld from these types of payments.
The
fourth bullet indicates a proposal relating
to... Mr. Arneson, Senator Nelson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have just one brief question on that. I believe, was there a change from needing to opt in as opposed to the need to opt out regarding withholding? There's been a lot of questions about that over the interim here, and I just wanted some clarity on the opt-in or opt-out piece. Did we change the process for
Madam
withholding?
Chair and members, I think there was a fair amount of discussion in the conference committee about the opt-in out, opt-in or opt-out concept. The provision that was adopted didn't really change anything about opting in or out, except that it provided that the payment is subject to this statutorily indicated withholding rate, rather than treated as if it were a payment of wages.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. It must be a federal issue then that is causing some of the disconnect. Now we'll follow up on that.
Madam Chair, members, Ms. Pollack may know more about this particular issue. This is one that she worked on.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson.
Ms. Pollack.
Yes, I think that's right. As I'm remembering now, there are federal requirements about wage withholding for, you know, federally governed retirement distributions. The current law in Minnesota was that distributions would be treated as wages subject to our state-specific withholding rules. So there is some interaction with federal withholding requirements there. What this would do was only specific to the Minnesota withholding rules, allowing the flat 6.25% withholding rate or any other rate that the recipient specifies.
Thank you.
Mr.
Madam Chair and members, the next item relates to the homestead credit refund increase. And in general, this would have increased refunds for qualifying applicants by a dollar amount for all income ranges, reduced the threshold percentages for claimants, and reduced the copay percentages for claimants. And if members have specific questions on this, I'll refer them to other staff.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the next two bullet items relating to the homestead market value exclusion and the school district local optional revenue, I think were duplicated. Those were actually described earlier by Mr. Sylvia in Article 4. Which brings us to the bullet relating to the combined net receipts tax modifications. In general, this would have reduced the first tier tax rate from 9% to 5% with corresponding bracket modifications and would result in a almost $7 million per year reduction in general fund revenues. And there were a couple other technical sections relating to other distributions to compulsive and problem gambling programs to hold those distributions harmless against the main element of this proposal.
Mr. Arneson, I want to go back to the equalization increase. I myself don't have any issue with including that in the omnibus tax bill. And certainly we have credits for individuals based on education expenses, et cetera. And it is a, but that's an individual benefit. It seems to me that even if we put that in the equalization aid in the tax bill, it should be part of the target of the Education Finance Committee and not of the Tax Committee. It's inappropriately placed here. We can put the language here, but the money should come out of their budget and not the target for the Tax Committee. And I will be arguing that at a later point as well.
Madam Chair, members, on that point about the kind of interplay between K-12 bill and the taxes committee, obviously there are some school property taxes that are in the primary jurisdiction of the K-12 committee. In the event that, you know, a K-12 bill modifies school property tax levies, for example,
yeah,
you know, then that bill also is in the jurisdiction of the taxes committee.
Yeah.
And a bill like that would come through the taxes committee before it would be reported to the floor.
And I believe, Mr. Arneson, it comes to the tax committee before it goes to finance. Is that the case,
Chair,
or does it go to finance?
I think it often happens that way. Yeah.
Beg pardon?
I said, Madam Chair, I believe it often happens in that order.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, we're getting near to the end of the miscellaneous article. The next item is the Housing Development Fund Workforce and Affordable Homeownership Account. This was a House proposal brought into conference committee. And in general, it would have allowed the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, or MHFA, to issue loans in addition to grants, and would have established a workforce and affordable homeownership development account to fund that program and to manage the kind of the loan repayments in that account. And it would have dedicated a portion of the general fund proceeds from the mortgage and deed tax to that account for the loan program. Madam Chair, members, the Polar Vortex Energy Rebate Grants is kind of complementary to what Ms. Pollack described earlier about other efforts around the Polar Vortex. This particular program would have, on a one-time basis, spent nearly $15 million from the general fund on payments to utilities that had charged a sort of incremental amount to their customers as a result of the polar vortex, and the bill language would have required then the utilities that received any grant from the state to make a distribution to those customers and required some evidence that happened and so on. And lastly, the county pandemic rental assistance payments. This, again, would have been a one-time program for $20 million in fiscal 23. It would have spent state general fund money on payments to counties, allocated to the counties on a sort of proportional basis per that county's count of rent-burdened households, you know, relative to the state total. And again, that, that came into conference from the House. And Madam Chair, that concludes the overview of the miscellaneous article, Article 10.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson. We, the rest of the articles are proposals from the Department of Revenue, both in policy and technical provisions. They are seldom controversial. What will be my approach when we hear these bills, if there's anything that is objectionable to any member, we will simply remove it by motion so that we will be putting in to the omnibus bill those provisions that the Department of Revenue and the members of this committee agree are either truly technical or the policy makes sense to all of us. So we won't need to go through those again right now. Is there any further comment from any member? Sarah Klein.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. On the entire process, or
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I just wanted to thank you for actually this approach to reviewing what we put in the omnibus with Senator Weber and Senator Carlson and yourself put into the omnibus last year. It's a real good refresher on the discussions that we had and the reasons we made the decisions that we did. And I think it's going to be a good launching pad for what we try to accomplish this year. Will there be an opportunity, and maybe you spoke about it while I was out, to review the spreadsheet on this?
Well, we can certainly ask I guess it's Mr. Munn looking over there, to provide us with them. I think that brings us down from a 30,000-foot level look at it, but perhaps we can have a kind of a telescoped look at that at Senator Klein's request.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, Casey Mum, fiscal analyst. Senator Klein, the spreadsheet that was prepared for the committee report last year was drawn to the February 2022 forecast. We've since had the November forecast come out, which in addition to updating all of the underlying economic factors used to price these items, also added the fiscal year 26-27 biennium. So the numbers that were in that spreadsheet prepared for the committee report last year are mostly all out of date. And you know, the conformity provisions have been repriced for the bill that will be on the floor tomorrow. And similarly, as bills are introduced containing these provisions and heard by the committee, there will be an updated revenue estimate prepared. At that point, we can see updated numbers for both the upcoming biennium and the fiscal 26-27 biennium.
So perhaps, Senator Klein, looking at last year's spreadsheet will not be particularly instructive or helpful for us right now. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for holding this public meeting about
sure.
The good work that was done, and maybe as a starting point moving forward, bringing us all with that same background knowledge. You know, I was just realizing there's one thing that I didn't see on here, and that was the total elimination of taxation on Social Security benefits. Where was that?
I said at the beginning that since we're going to have a hearing on Senator Putnam's bill on Thursday, that we've set aside any discussion of that as well as conformity since we'd already passed it out of the committee.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Yep. Makes so much sense.
Anybody else? Senator Spalsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, is our ending time 10 o'clock or 10:30 on this committee?
It's 10:30, but you're going to get out early.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Miss Senator Rest. Sure. Is there any further comments? I want to thank fiscal staff and Senate Counsel for making this presentation to us and distilling what was in that committee report. It's very helpful to me, and I hope to the members, and will be the basis then for discussion, presentations, or comments from people either supporting or opposing the articles that were presented to us today, tomorrow. And again, if you want to say something about any of the things that are in here, make sure you put your name on the list for Mr. Berggren, and we hope people will be very, very brief and but certainly take the time to make your point. So there being no further business before the committee, we're adjourned.